Hello, and thank you for joining the American Revolution. Today, episode 47, The Suffolk Resolves. So last week we discussed attempts by both General Gage and the Massachusetts militia to grab as much arms and ammunition as they could get. Gage quickly realized that the problem was not just a few radicals in Boston. The entire colony would resist the government and the military. Gage barricaded himself in Boston and sent word to Lord Dartmouth and others in London that he was going to need many more soldiers if they wanted to retake the colony. Gage put a battery of cannon on Boston Neck to prevent any invasion by land and put naval vessels in place to prevent anyone from moving in or out of the town by water. By September 1774, the colonial government controlled only Boston. The governor completely lost control of the rest of the colony. Gage accepted this fact and seemed content to remain in Boston until he could begin a new campaign in the spring. He sent several letters to Lord Dartmouth in London calling for reinforcements of at least 20,000. As Gage put it, quote, "A large force will terrify and engage many to join you. A middling one will encourage resistance and gain no friends," end quote. In short, Gage wanted overwhelming force. Otherwise, you would basically be poking a bear with a stick. Until he could get sufficient reinforcements, presumably sometime in the spring of 1775, he would sit tight and remain on the defensive. While waiting for London, Gage brought in some reinforcements of his own that fall, transferring regiments from Quebec, Newfoundland, and New York to Boston. Even after the reinforcements arrived in October, his force totaled only around 3,000 men. He divided his force into three brigades, one under General Hugh Percy, also known as Lord Percy, a second under General Robert Pigot, and a third under Lieutenant Colonel Valentine Jones, who received a brevet commission as general. His troops continued to drill and prepare, but went into winter quarters. Gage focused his immediate attention on gathering intelligence and preparing for the spring campaign. With only one or two exceptions, the army would remain inside Boston until spring. In order to fill the power vacuum, Suffolk County, which includes Boston and the surrounding area, held a meeting. Top Patriot leaders, Thomas Cushing, Samuel and John Adams, and Robert Treat Paine had left in August for the Continental Congress in Philadelphia. Dr. Joseph Warren of Boston led the meeting. Even without the top leaders, momentum for resistance and rebellion continued to grow among the population. Before we dive into the resolves themselves, I want to say a few words about Joseph Warren. I've mentioned him in a few episodes now, but have not given him much of a background. Warren was a medical doctor in Boston. He was native-born to Massachusetts and a graduate of Harvard College. Although he was only in his early 30s in 1774, he had been active in the Patriot cause for quite some time. In the 1760s, he had become an early leader of the Patriot cause, working with the Sons of Liberty, with Hancock and the Adamses during the Stamp Act protests and beyond. He was the doctor who conducted the autopsy of Christopher Sidens, the boy who was killed just before the Boston Massacre. He also assisted with the committee report on the Boston Massacre. He delivered two public orations for the anniversary commemorations of the Boston Massacre, and for years he had served on committees of correspondence and safety for the Patriots. He also wrote numerous newspaper articles furthering the Patriot cause. By late 1774, he was one of Samuel Adams's top lieutenants in the resistance, which is why he took command when Adams and the other top leaders left for the Continental Congress. I think it is telling that Adams left Warren in charge rather than John Hancock. Hancock had at times behaved with a little too much moderation, some might call it timidity. Warren, on the other hand, had always shown his commitment to the Patriot cause. As a well-respected Patriot leader, Warren was more than ready to lead the meeting that approved the resolves. Warren had begun working on the resolves even before the powder alarm set everyone on edge on September 1st. The week before, committees of correspondence had met in Faneuil Hall in Boston to discuss their opposition and urge the closing of all the courts rather than operating under the coercive acts. Suffolk County was not the only county to draft similar resolves regarding their actions, but since the Suffolk Resolves went to the Continental Congress for approval, they tend to get the most attention. The other resolves make clear, though, that radical sentiments expressed were not unique to Boston. The general populace, or at least a significant percentage of it, throughout the colony, pretty much felt the same way. Initial meetings to prepare the Suffolk Resolves took place in the private homes in Milton and Dedham. Warren introduced them on September 6th at a convention meeting of the Committees of Correspondence. After days of editing and discussion, the committees approved them. On September 9th, the commission met at the Woodward Tavern in Dedham. There, the convention gave unanimous approval to the 19 resolves. Now, if you've never read the Suffolk Resolves, I recommend doing so. They are only 3 or 4 pages long and spell out the radical patriot view that makes the road to independence seem almost inevitable. I thought about reading the full text here, but decided it would be better to discuss it in my own words. Of course, if you want to read the original text, you can find it at a link on my blog. And this might be a good time to note that my blog has a new domain, so pay attention. The new address is blog.amrevpodcast.com. Now, coming right on the heels of the powder alarm, when the colonists were literally taking up arms to challenge the army, the resolves capture the hostile sentiment of the people. The preamble proclaims that their ancestors had fled the persecution of Great Britain, which now sought to use its power and vengeance against the colonists. Their ancestors had sacrificed and toiled to build a free and just society that they now enjoyed. Now the British sought to destroy all that by asserting full sovereign power over the colony and reducing its people to a state of slavery. The colonists' only choice was to submit to slavery or resist. Clearly, they favored the latter. The first resolve starts off on a conciliatory note. It recognizes King George III as their rightful sovereign, and the colonists proclaim their continued allegiance. Up until the Declaration of Independence in 1776, almost all colonial documents stressed their loyalty to the king. Many of them held that the king would support their rights. He just needed to stand up to Parliament and assert his authority. It is unclear whether the colonists were truly ignorant of the fact that the king wholeheartedly supported and even encouraged Lord North's colonial policies, or whether they simply chose to pretend ignorance in order to give the king an opportunity to change policies and appoint a new ministry once he realized that North's policy of coercion would not work. The second resolve proclaims their duty to fight for the rights and liberties established by their forefathers. They recognize that they only have the rights they have because their ancestors fought for them. This generation had to continue that fight to keep the freedoms for their descendants. The third and fourth resolves criticize Parliament for closing Boston Harbor, altering the colonial charter, and allowing accused criminals to be removed for trial elsewhere. They proclaim that they will not obey such laws. Now, these resolves specifically focus on the coercive acts passed a few months earlier as the cause of the current crisis. There is no mention of taxes or the longer-term fights over trade rules. Those are still a problem, but they are not why the people object to the colonial government. It is the laws that Parliament created to compel obedience that are causing the current disobedience. The fifth and sixth resolves focus on the appointment of judges. Because such appointments violate their colonial charter as it existed before the coercive acts, the people should ignore any court orders from judges acting under these unconstitutional laws. It calls on sheriffs, jurors, and others to ignore the courts and refuse to obey them. In the absence of a working court system, it calls on the colonists to try to resolve disputes or submit to arbitration. Anyone using the colonial courts going forward will be deemed to be collaborating with the enemy. The seventh resolve calls on tax collectors and other local officials not to send any taxes to the illegitimate colonial government. Rather, they should hold all money until a proposed provincial Congress could be established. While London paid the salaries of a few colonial officials, most of the money needed to run the local government came from local taxes. These had never been a matter of contention. The colonists had always paid taxes authorized by their elected colonial legislature to support the government. Now, Parliament's changes to the charter rendered the whole government illegitimate. Another resolve we'll get into in a minute discusses the creation of a new provincial Congress to run things. But in the meantime, we're not going to hand over our money to the illegitimate government when the new government is going to need it. The eighth resolve calls on the colonists who have accepted seats on the governor's council to resign. Most appointees had done so already. The resolve tells the holdouts that if they do not do so by September 20th, less than 2 weeks away, they will be considered enemies of this country. Again, the colonial government appointed under the Coercive Acts is illegitimate. No more time for compromise, it's time to pick a side. If you work for the colonial government, you are an enemy of the people. The ninth resolve criticizes the fortifications the army is building on Boston Neck. They fear it might cause people to think the army has some hostile intention against them. The resolve also attacks Governor Gates for removing powder from the Quarry Hill Powder House, and also his decision to prohibit Boston authorities from returning powder to private owners. Hey guys, we're all friends here. Why are you suddenly acting so hostile? I've got to think Gage laughed when he read this one. The people are planning an armed revolt, and they are going to be upset when the army wants to defend itself and not hand over guns and ammunition to be used against them. Really? The 10th resolve attacks the Quebec Act. It accuses Parliament of establishing Catholicism and French laws. They see this as a danger to Protestants and to the whole continent's rights and liberties as free Englishmen. Colonists had fought multiple wars over the last century, trying to push the Canadian French Catholics back, at great cost of both lives and money. The Canadians had repeatedly invaded their borders and stirred up Indian tribes against them. This was an age-old war between two distinct civilizations. Finally, with the end of the French and Indian War, the English had won. The French were out of Canada, and the English were in control. Now, after they had won, Parliament was giving the French everything they ever wanted. French-speaking colonists with their Catholic religion and French laws, which did not include an elected legislature, would now push against the borders of the English colonies, all under the authority of the British government. What the heck? The 11th resolve calls for a complete restructuring of the colonial militia. It recommends taking away commissions from all current militia officers. Each local militia should elect new officers based on both competence and whether they are willing to support colonial rights. It also calls on the new militia to prepare for war and to drill at least weekly. In the past, militias tended to be casual affairs. They would meet about 4 times a year for 1 day of drill. Most drill days tended to be an excuse for a town-wide party, where everyone came with families, watched the militia parade, and had a picnic. Now, though, it was time to get serious and prepare for war. I guess, fearing the 11th resolve might be taken as an act of treason, preparing for war against the government, the 12th resolve reiterates their affection for the king and promises to use the militia only defensively to protect themselves. We want to be ready just in case. Really, we're not planning to attack the army. It didn't really matter. Within days of receiving the document, the British Attorney General declared the resolves to be treasonous. The 13th resolve addresses the fear that officials are planning to arrest the leaders of any resistance. If that happens, the people resolve to take hostages of any official working for the colonial government and hold them until any prisoners are released. This was a legitimate concern. In fact, Lord North would soon order Gage to arrest the ringleaders and ship them back to London. Gage, however, understood by now that arresting a few leaders would do nothing. The rebellious attitudes were embedded throughout the colony. Arresting a few leaders would not stop anything, but would almost certainly inflame more acts of violence. Still, the colonists were putting the government on notice that they would not tolerate any arrests and would take their own prisoners if Gage tried anything. The 14th resolve calls for a complete end to all trade with Britain, Ireland, and the West Indies. an agreement to abstain from the consumption of all British merchandise and manufactures, including anything from the East Indies, that is, anything the East India Company controls. This reiterated essentially the same thing the Boston Town Meeting had called for when word of the Port Act first reached the colonies, the so-called Solemn League and Covenant that we discussed a few weeks ago. It was the main issue under debate at the Continental Congress. Economic boycotts had worked before. It was the best way to challenge Britain, absent military rebellion. The 15th resolve calls for the creation of a committee to consider the best ways to promote local arts and manufacturing, presumably to take the place of goods manufactured in Britain. If a complete boycott was going to work, colonies would have to do more for themselves. As much as Parliament wanted to keep the colonies dependent on Britain, the colonists now fought to make sure that they could operate economically independent of Britain. The 16th resolve calls for the creation of a provincial congress to take the place of the colonial government. Specifically, it calls on all local towns to select members to attend such a congress in Concord on the second Tuesday of October. A call for a provincial congress really was an act of independence. Massachusetts would create its own government without any involvement from London. Even under the new laws, it still had an elected legislature in the colonial government. But that legislature's power was so limited and under the thumb of the appointed governor and council that it could not act as a voice of the people. This new Congress would act on its own authority and do whatever it liked. The 17th resolve pays respect to the Continental Congress then meeting in Philadelphia. The resolve promises to, quote, pay all due respect and submission, end quote, to anything Congress recommends to the colonies to reestablish their rights and restore harmony between Britain and its colonies. Even the most radical leader in Massachusetts realized that an all-out war between Britain and Massachusetts would not go well for the colony. Even while they created a new government and prepared for war, they really hoped that the moderates would find a way to convince Britain to back down and compromise. At the very least, Massachusetts needed the other colonies to join with them in resistance. Going it alone was not an option. Therefore, they hoped the Continental Congress could find a political solution. The 18th resolve calls on the people to respect private property during this time when government is effectively absent. It calls on the people to avoid riots or any other attacks on people or property. They want to impress on the outside world that this is not a lawless mob, but rather a free people worthy of keeping their rights and liberties. If the colony fell into anarchy, it would only hurt any support for their cause. The 19th and final resolve calls for the creation of a committee or select individuals in each town to serve as dispatch riders. Should an army attempt to launch any sort of attack, the dispatch riders would seek assistance from neighboring towns and alert the countryside to any attack. It seemed inevitable that sooner or later the British Army in Boston would once again venture out to threaten some other part of the colony. Without a standing army to oppose them, communication between all local militia had to get the word out on a moment's notice. Warren submitted the resolves to the convention pretty much as a fait accompli. There was little debate over the language or whether they should accept or reject one resolve or another. The convention approved the resolves as a whole and had them published. The Massachusetts Gazette printed a special supplement on December 16th for distribution all over the colony. And again, on my website, I have a link to that supplement if you'd like to read it in full. Paul Revere carried a copy of the resolves to the Continental Congress in Philadelphia. Next week, we'll take a look at how Congress responds to these resolves.